time, we derived quite a bit of information starting from just the Dirac algebra in D dimensions. We found that the dimensionality of the Dirac representation is 2 to the power the integer part of d by 2 times 2 to the power the integer part of d by 2. That's the dimensionality of the Dirac matrices. And therefore, the dimensionality of the Dirac spinners has to be 2 to the power integer part of d by 2. And that just follows from the fact that the matrix and the object it acts on have to be compatible. And then we saw that in even dimensional space-time, although we did it only for 4 dimensions, that the Dirac spinner can be decomposed into a left-handed vowel part and a right-handed vowel part. So in even dimensional space-time, the Dirac representation is reducible. In odd dimensional space-time, it is not reducible. And we also saw that in 4D, in what is known as the chiral representation, which is defined by the fact that gamma 5, the chirality operator, has this simple form, has a block diagonal form. In that representation, the Dirac matrices are given by this off-diagonal block form, where sigma mu are the generalization of the Pauli matrices, which includes an identity as a zeroth component, and sigma mu bar is given by this. Okay. So any questions from last time? Yeah?
So you explained how you can go from SO13 to SO14.
Right.
You can also go from SO15 down to SO14 by just restricting the spinner representation.
So can you not go one from SO15 to SO14?
Yeah, that go down one dimension. It's just like the subgroup.
Yes, of course you can, yeah.
So do you not have the spinner representation that's potentially reducible?
You're saying that your spinner representation in SO15...
You restrict this one to SO14.
But it's reducible in terms of a smaller group, right? So So in that sense, yes, it is reducible. But here, what we're saying is that, but I don't think it's a reducible in the group theoretic sense, though. So it's kind of what you're saying is that we have this representation of a big group. And inside that big group, can we find smaller representation of a smaller group? And of course, you're going to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. All right, so today we are going to hopefully end up building some Lagrangians for spinners. And since in 4D, the wall spinners are the smallest objects that we work with, we are going to end up at some point building up everything that we have in terms of wall spinners. But before that, just a very brief comment. On the Lie algebra structure of the Lorentz group. So the Lorentz group, the Lie algebra, so this is like small hand, can be written as the sum of 2 SU2s, which is sometimes called the SU2 left and the SU2 right. And recall that the rotations in Lorentz group is given by 3 matrices, which we can, I'm just using the sigma notation, but you can have M or whatever. These are just generators of the Lorentz group. So these are what we call rotations. And the boosts are just the zero I components. And a more traditional, a non-covariant way of writing the Lie algebra or the Lorentz algebra is in this way, and it's easier to remember. So the rotations, of course, satisfy the angular momentum algebra. And the boosts do not form a subgroup. And to close the algebra, you need this. Now, it's not a very difficult exercise to show that. If you now define these generators, so they're complex linear combination. Then using the Lie algebra for the Lorentz group or the Lorentz algebra, you can show that the commutator of these n's give you another SU2 and the n daggers also give you another SU2. Verifying the statement that the Lie algebra of SO1, 3 splits up into two SU2s. Coming back to your comment, that's actually kind of important when you're applying, doing string theory, because you start with a higher dimensional space-time, and then you compactify down to a smaller dimensional space-time. So the spin representation of smaller dimensional space-time have to live in the higher dimensional space-time. So there you actually have to learn the mathematics of how to expand those out in terms of the small representation. So since we have two SU2s, each of these SU2s will have a Casimir. Yeah?
On the right side, it appears to be something about I and J.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Thank you. So now that we have two SU2s, each will have a total angular momentum quantum number. It's a formally angular momentum quantum number. And so if this is the quantum number of the Casimir of this guy, let's call this M, and this one is N. So two numbers will label the representations of SO1, 3. And the wild representation, the left-handed wild representation, is the half comma zero, and the right-handed wild representation is 0, half. Even the vector representation, you can build up from tensoring these objects together. That's all very formal and mathematical. So let's move on to our topic of the day, which is we're going to construct Lorentz invariants from spinners. So for this, we will need to know some properties of how spinners and the Lorentz transformations on spinners, how they behave under Hermitian conjugation. So just by using the properties of Dirac matrices, you can show this easily. And let me just show you. We know that gamma 0 is Hermitian. And gamma 0 squares to 1. So we can insert a gamma 0. So which shows gamma 0, gamma 0, gamma 0. And if you take the spatial components, then you know that they are anti-Hermitian. So again, you can insert a gamma 0 squared because that's just 1. And because gamma I and gamma 0 anti-commutes, you get gamma 0, gamma I, gamma 0, which proves these relationships. So using this, you can show that the if you take the Hermitian conjugate of the generators in the Dirac representation, then you know this is given by so I've there's a minus sign because the I has to be complex conjugated. The dagger is outside the commutator. When you take the dagger inside the commutator, the ordering will change because we know that Hermitian conjugation, which involves a transposition, will change the inverse the ordering of matrices, right? And then because the anticommutator, the commutator is antisymmetric, you know, we can write this like this. And then using this formula and the fact that gamma 0 squares to 1, you know, we end up in this with this expression. So what this implies is that so if you start with how the spinner transforms, the Dirac spinner transforms, it transforms according to our definition of S in this way. And then if you take the Hermitian conjugate of this guy, you find right multiplying psi dagger an object, this matrix is not the inverse of this matrix. If the generators were Hermitian, then of course this would be inverse of this. So the naive guess that you would make that maybe this could be a Lorentz invariant quantity does not work because the matrices sandwiched between these two guys do not cancel each other out. However, this object is positive. So that's related to the fact that this is a finite dimensional non-unitary representation of the Lorentz group. So Dirac introduced what is now known as a Dirac conjugate, which is the dagger of psi right multiplied by gamma zero. So now, so how does gamma bar transform? By the way, this bar has nothing to do with that sigma bar. Okay? Just. So the dagger comes with it. It comes with this matrix. But it is right multiplied by gamma zero. Now, the gamma matrices are just constant matrices. They do not transform under space-time transformation, under Lorentz transformation. But they do have interesting properties when you sandwich them between Lorentz transformation. We'll see that. So then what we do is that we squared, we insert gamma zero squared, and everything else remains the same. And then we have gamma bar. What we take one of these psi bar, we take one of these gamma zeros and right multiply it by this thing. And then we have gamma zero, the matrix. And then we can expand the matrix, and we'll get a power series in sigma. And within each pair of sigma, we can insert gamma zero squared, because that's just one. and then just use that relationship and then find that this thing is right. So this matrix happens to be the inverse of this matrix, and therefore we have proved that psi bar of x, psi of x, is a Lorentz scalar. Right? Now there are a slew of other objects that transform in some tensorial way under Lorentz transformation that we can construct from bilinears of the Dirac spinner sandwiching gamma matrices between them. But before I do that, it's actually very useful to classify these according to a discrete transformation of the Lorentz group called parity. So let me take a very brief detour on the discrete transformation that are part of the Lorentz group. So I hinted earlier that the Lorentz group is actually 1, 0, 1, 3. Because if you take the Lorentz matrices, they are defined by this, and the most general solution of that is this group. So that means that in this group, there are transformations such as there's one called parity. It's usually denoted by P. So this is a Lorentz transformation. So to emphasize the fact that this is a Lorentz transformation, I'm going to write it as lambda. And what it does is that it just inverts the spatial direction. So it takes all the space-time points and maps them onto their spatial inverse. So this is known as the parity transformation. And the parity has determinant -1. And that's why it's not connected to the Lorentz transformation SO1,3, because SO1,3 are continuously related to the identity and they have a determinant 1. The other Lorentz transformation that is not included in the continuous Lorentz group is time inversion. And that has the form, as you can guess, has this form. So what it does is that it inverts the arrow of time. It just takes t to minus t. So when you include this, then your Lorentz transformation becomes non-orthochronous. So this is time inversion. So there's a very famous and important theorem in relativistic QFTs, which says that a consistent relativistic QFT doesn't have to be invariant under time inversion or parity or another transformation called a charge conjugation, which takes the particles to antiparticles. That a consistent QFT doesn't have to be invariant under these transformations separately, but they have to be invariant under all this transformation together, C, P, and T. And this is known as the CPT theorem. So it says that right. In fact, very famously, the standard model violates parity. And not only that, it violates parity maximally. And you will see that how that is implemented in your standard model course. But as a result, it is convenient to transform, to classify all the Lorentz covariant objects that we can write down using spinner bilinears to classify them using how they behave under parity. So if you're going to do that, we have to know how a spinner transforms under the parity transformation. And I'm just going to get ahead a little bit and motivate this by using a physical argument. This is borrowed from Peskin. So the physical argument is that when you actually solve the Dirac equation, which we will see later today, and then you take the limit, ultra-relativistic limit, so that you can ignore the masses, you will see that the Dirac spinner splits up into, the Dirac equation splits up into two equations, one for the left-handed wall spinner, one for the right-handed wall spinner. So we know that the left-handed wall, the wall spinners are eigenstates of gamma 5, the helicity operator. But you can also show that the wall spinners are also eigenstates of the helicity operator. Okay? And what is helicity? Helicity is it's the projection of your angular momentum onto the direction of your momentum. Now, because the angular momentum in the definition of, so the total angular momentum will consist orbital angular momentum and spin angular momentum. The orbital angular momentum has in it r cross p. So that part will not contribute to this dot product. So for our cases, for particles, the helicity essentially becomes the projection of the spin along the linear momentum. So let's consider the sine of the helicity, which is something like this. And the claim is that if you reflect a wall spinner on a mirror, it flips the sign of the helicity. So let me show you how this works. So suppose you have a wall spinner going in this direction. So this is its P. And it has some angular momentum, spin, which I will denote like that. And here's a mirror. What you're going to see is that the mirror image, the P will be going in this direction. But the spin will be, you know, the rotation will be in the same direction, right? So under the reflection, the sign of helicity flips. Now you might say, what does this have to do with parity? The idea is that parity is essentially a reflection in a mirror plus a two-dimensional rotation. Yeah?
But for this one, this parity is not dependent on your frame. Right? For this one, you have the linear momentum which depends on where you boost the direction. Does it affect?
Sorry, what's your question? Can you repeat it?
Helicity depends on which frame you are in. Because
right. It does. Helicity depends on what reference frame you are in, but the idea is that, you know, again, as I'm saying, I'm anticipating things which will come in the future, is that when particles with a wall spinner is essentially a massless particle. So you cannot flip the sign of the linear momentum by boosting yourself.
Okay.
And so that's why, you know, we are kind of, I'm using information from the future to motivate this. But all I need you to know is that under reflection, the sign of helicity flips. That's all we need to know. The sign of helicity of a wall spinner flips. So the other comment I wanted to make is that, yeah?
What do you mean by a wall spinner? The wall spinner? Is massless? Isn't like a fermion? Isn't any fermion? Every fermion has a corresponding spinner, no?
Right. So if a wall, we'll write down an action for a wall spinner, and we'll see that for a wall spinner, you know, if it's a truly wall spinner, it cannot have a mass term. We'll see that, you know, like by the end of this lecture today. And therefore, you know, a spinner, which is a wall spinner, is actually a massless object, and therefore, you know, for example, before we discovered neutrinos have masses, how did we mathematically describe neutrinos? We described them using a wall spinner without a mass term. And it's logically perfectly possible for neutrinos not to have masses. And then it would actually be, if that were the case, it's not the case we know now, then the wall spinner, it would actually be an eigenstate of the helicity operator. Okay? So there, you know, in the old standard model, we only had left-handed neutrinos and right-handed antineutrinos. There was no such thing as a right-handed neutrino.
Isn't it just not interact with anything?
Sorry?
Isn't it?
It does interact with other, even in the old standard model, they had interactions and everything. They were weakly interacting, but they had interactions. Okay, so one thing I wanted to say is that, you know, parity is essentially reflections in a mirror and a 180 degree rotation in the plane of the mirror. Right? Just think about it. So therefore, this is actually, what we're doing in this case is actually a parity transformation as well. So since the left-handed wall spinner is mapped to a right-handed wall spinner under parity, this motivates us to claim that this thing is implemented by, in this way. So we have a Dirac spinner. So now I have a Dirac spinner. Under parity, it should change its left-handed and right-handed part. So just think, in the curve representation, its gamma zero is the matrix, which it has off-diagonal parts. So if you just multiply the Dirac spinner by gamma zero. And of course, because we are doing parity, we have to change the argument in this way. So the action of parity is this. So from now on, I'm just going to drop the D subscript. So psi dagger then, of course, transforms like this under parity. So then, let me now classify all the different Lorentz covariant objects that we will need. There are others you can introduce, but we won't need them. So we've already seen the Lorentz scalar. Oh, by the way, from now on, I'm also going to drop, I'm just going to write the argument for this guy. But after that, I'm going to drop the arguments. So first, we have already met the scalar. So under parity, what happens is the scalar just goes to itself. So there's a minus in the x here. To show this, what you have to do is that, you know, so let's show this. So this goes to, you know, psi dagger gamma zero, but there was another gamma zero in the definition of psi bar, and this guy goes becomes gamma zero of psi. So these two give you one. So this gives you psi bar, which is this thing, right? So this is very easy to show. There's another class of objects called pseudoscalar. So pseudoscalars are a bit like Canadians. To Americans, they seem like Americans until they realize they're not Americans. So this is a bad joke I heard long ago. Sorry? So pseudoscalars are of this form. So if you just insert a gamma 5, you can show that this thing transforms like a scalar under the connected components of the Lorentz group. And that's easy to show because gamma 5 doesn't do anything when you do the transformations. And then, you know, you can just use the usual properties that gamma 5 actually commutes with all the transformations of the Lorentz group. So under parity, however, now the gamma 0 that you pick up here and you pick up here, they have to be anti-commuted through gamma 5. And then the gamma 0 square will give you 1. So that'll pick up a minus sign. And so we have, this is the way it'll transform. So this is a pseudoscalar. And then a vector, the way you construct a vector is by sandwiching a gamma mu and under parity, what happens is the zeroth component of this guy does not change, but the spatial components flip sign. And that's exactly what you expect of a vector, a three-dimensional vector. When you reflect it in a mirror, you know, if you apply P, it should change all its you know, components. And then we have what is called a pseudo or axial vector. And what that object, you've guessed it, has a gamma 5 in its definition. And under parity, it's the time component which picks up a sign. But the space components remain invariant. Can you give me an example of a three-dimensional vector that is an axial vector? Louder?
Cross product.
Angular momentum, yeah. Any vector that you create by, you know, taking the cross product of two fundamental space-time vectors, like angular momentum, right? Because both of those guys will flip signs under parity, so the whole thing will work. So you can also so you can define some, you know, tensor, an antisymmetric tensor by, you know, sandwiching the antisymmetric combination of gammas. And so you can build higher form antisymmetric tensors and pseudo tensors out of them. Okay? So at last, we are ready to write down or construct our first Lagrangian for spinners. So let us write down the kinetic term. So L for spinners, L for Lagrangian. So let's use the notation where this thing is, I think we've already used it before, but so the simplest kinetic term that we can write down, which is also Lorentz invariant, is this. We, of course, need a derivative. Otherwise, our theory will not be dynamical. And before I show that this is Lorentz invariant, let's ask, why didn't we write down a term which was, say, of this form? Right? Because that would also be a kinetic term. Nothing about this term shouts out to us that, you know, those guys are spinners, right? We will show that for this to be Lorentz invariant, we will have to make use of the fact that psi is a spinner, gamma mu acts on the spinner space, the spinorialness of all these objects will have to be used, whereas this doesn't have to use that, right? That's just like one point. The other point is that when we quantize our spinners to get fermions, we will have to use, to be consistent with observation and the spin statistics theorem, we will have to use anti-commutators, not commutators, as you saw in classical field theory. So if you then construct the Hamiltonian, for such a theory out of this Lagrangian, you'll find that the Hamiltonian is not bounded from below. So it'll be an unstable theory. So that's even a better reason not to consider this as your kinetic term. Okay. So let's now show that this is Lorentz invariant. Before I do that, let me write down the action. Actually, let's do the dimensional analysis first. So the kinetic part of any action would be just your Lagrangian d4x. And people don't write it because in the Cartesian coordinate, the determinant of the metric is 1. But I will write it just once. And that's because in life, you might come across a situation where you may have to use a coordinate system other than the Cartesian coordinate, say a spherical polar coordinate system. In that case, square root of minus g is not 1. Okay, but in this course, we are going to be in Cartesian coordinates. So let's do a bit of dimensional analysis. So we are using units in which c is 1 and h bar is 1. In such units, the mass dimensions of the action. So this is what I mean by the mass dimension. That's zero, right? Because h bar has the same unit as your action. And h bar doesn't have any, it's a dimensionless quantity in our units, right? However, the stuff that goes into the action, such as the measure has mass dimension minus 4, because these are just four lengths and time, three lengths and one time. The derivative has one mass dimension because it's 1 over its length. The gamma matrices, they are just numbers. So they're dimensionless. So this leaves us that for this to be true, psi and its Hermitian conjugate, which will have the same mass dimension because Hermitian conjugation should not change its dimensionality, is 3/2. So this is the dimensions of the spinner. So we can then introduce a mass term, and the mass term is, if you write, there's a constant m. So we can ask, what is the, given that we know the mass dimensions of psi and psi bar, what is the mass dimension of m? Because the mass dimension of Lagrangian has to be plus 4 so that it cancels this minus 4 to give s equals to 0. So this is 1. If, right? So everything is fine. By the way we have written the action, if you take its complex conjugate, then you can show that this is real, but only up to an integration by parts. So by integration by parts, the action is real. So upon quantization, you know, the action will become an operator because everything inside is would be an operator. Then that would become Hermitian. Okay. So classically, we need things to be real so that when, you know, things like the action to be real, so that when we actually quantize it, we will get a theory with Hermitian action. Okay, so let us quickly derive okay. I'm going to skip this part, but using the Euler-Lagrange equation for the conjugate or spinner, the Dirac conjugate spinner, psi bar, you can derive the Dirac equation. Or if you want, if you use the Euler-Lagrange equation for the Dirac spinner, you will get the Hermitian conjugate of the Dirac equation from this action. So as okay. So you can derive this thing, and I leave it as an exercise from that action, from the total action where L is L kinetic plus L mass. I've introduced here the Feynman slash notation, which is just this. I'm not sure how Dirac felt when he saw his equation being presented by Feynman in a famous conference in this notation. Okay, so now let's move on to writing down the Lagrangians that we can construct for wall spinners. So before we do that, let's revisit. Okay, I didn't really prove the Lorentz invariance of this yet. I'll prove the Lorentz invariance of the Weyl Lagrangians, and this will just be kind of a, you know, you can just generalize it from there. So in last lecture, we saw this equation. And I hinted that this has a kind of a geometric quality to it. To see it, we have to rewrite the right-hand term in terms of the generators of the Lorentz transformation. So by calligraphic M, I mean the generators of the fundamental representation of the Lorentz transformation. And this is given by delta alpha nu eta mu beta minus, right? So using this definition on the right-hand side, you can rewrite this equation like this. So this is a very suggestive equation. Whenever you have, when you see a commutator, you can express, you can think, your intuition should say, oh, it's probably an infinitesimal version of some similarity transformation. So the left-hand side is the infinitesimal version of this. The right-hand side is the infinitesimal version of a Lorentz transformation. A Lorentz matrix multiplying the gamma matrix. So these two equations are the same. So if you expand it if you expand this equation, both sides, for the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, and you have one on both sides, you knock off the one, the first order term gives you this. And some people will say, you know, this is how, make the statement, this is how a gamma matrix transforms on the Lorentz transformation. So technically, that's not a true statement, because the gamma matrix is just a constant matrix. They don't transform. But they do satisfy this very useful identity, which you have to use whenever you want to prove the invariance of these sort of actions. You have to use that. Or even when you have to prove the fact that this vector, that the psi bar gamma mu psi, it actually transforms like a Lorentz vector under a Lorentz transformation, you have to use that, this formula. So this is very, very, very important. Yeah. So now what we can do is that we can plug in the expressions for these guys in the chiral representation. Remember, in the chiral representation, you know, S had SL, SR here, and gamma mu's were of this form. So you can just plug in those and then derive how the sigma mu's and sigma mu bars, what are the corresponding identity that they satisfy? And they satisfy things like this. And in today's tutorial, there will be a supplementary exercise which will make use of all these identities. Okay. You guys, break is coming up in a few minutes, don't worry. So now let's ask the question, how do the left-handed and the right-handed wall spinners transform under a Lorentz transformation? Okay. Great. So if you now, so psi was, say, chi L and phi R. So this is in the chiral representation. Then psi bar is phi R dagger, chi L dagger. These two guys have switched places because there's an application by gamma zero, right? So make sure you understand this, because psi dagger is just chi L dagger, phi R dagger. Then, but in constructing psi bar, you right multiplied by gamma zero, which is off diagonal, which has, not off diagonal, it has, in block diagonal form, it's off diagonal, so it switches these two things, and that's what you get. So then, the Lorentz transformation of the Dirac spinner implies that chi L transforms in this way, psi R transforms in this way, but chi L dagger transforms not with SL, but SR inverse, okay? And phi R dagger transforms with phi R dagger SL inverse. We will use these facts in today's tutorial. So now, before our break, let's just write down the kinetic term for a left-handed wall spinner, which I claim is this thing, chi L dagger, sigma bar of mu. And then I'm claiming that this is Lorentz invariant. Let's prove that. So under Lorentz transformation, I remains I. Chi L dagger has an SR, right, multiplying it. Sigma bar mu is just a matrix, doesn't happen anything, doesn't do anything. But this is a vector, so this picks up a, this is a space-time vector, so it picks up a Lorentz transformation matrix. And chi L picks up an SL. But SL, these do not depend on space-time because these are just a spinner representation of the Lorentz group, so you can pull this through here. And then using the second of those expressions, we can write chi, this guy as lambda mu sigma bar sigma. There was a lambda here before. So here you see a Lorentz matrix, and you can think of this as the transpose of this matrix, multiplying this matrix. So these two together will give you a delta function, a Kronecker delta, like so. And when you use the Kronecker delta, this sigma becomes nu, and we get so we have shown that this Lagrangian is Lorentz invariant. Crucial to this was one of those identities which came from that identity which I've put in the box. Let's take, let's say 4 minutes break and come back here again, okay? So all these different matrices that we are calling SL, SR, SL inverse, SR inverse, they are all So SL, SL inverse, SR, SR inverse, they're all elements of the group SL2C. What is SL2C? These are the group of 2x2 matrices which have unit determinant with complex entries. Okay? So this, you can show, it has six parameters as well. And this is something we'll see more explicitly, how these things are related. They're related by complex conjugation and inversion. We'll see that in today's tutorial. Okay? So we wrote down the Lagrangian for a left-handed wild spinner. You might ask, what's the Lagrangian for a right-handed wild spinner? Well, that's easy to guess. You have phi r dagger, but instead of sigma bar, you have sigma mu. Sigma bar mu, you have just sigma mu. So this, you can show, is also invariant under Lorentz transformation. Now, what about a mass term? So a putative mass term for a wild spinner will have something like this form. Let me write. But you can show that this is not Lorentz invariant. Under Lorentz transformation, this will go to this object, and of course, this is not, these two things do not cancel out. So let me now express the Dirac Lagrangian in terms of the left-handed and the right-handed wall component of the Dirac spinner. So if you took the kinetic term for the Dirac Lagrangian and express it in the chiral basis, then we get chi L get exactly the sum of the kinetic term for the left-handed wild spinner and the right-handed wild spinner. Or I should call this the wild Lagrangian. So this is a... And what about the mass term? So if you express that in terms of chi and phi. So the Dirac mass term is this thing. And then it turns out that this is going to be minus m . So we see that you can interpret the Dirac mass term as a term which couples the left-handed and the right-handed wild spinners. So that's you can think of it as an interaction term between the left-handed and the right-handed, which allows left-handed part to be exchanged for right-handed part and stuff like that. Okay. There's another type of spinner which is actually very useful, especially for neutrino physics, and they're called the wild spinners. Sorry, Majorana spinners. So the Dirac spinner has four complex components, and therefore we can write the Dirac spinner in terms of two wild spinners, each of which has two complex coordinates. So this business is very, very confusing. We use the same words to mean very different things all the time. So a wild spinner is essentially, you know, an eigenstate of gamma 5. But the wild Lagrangian is different, right? A wild Lagrangian is a physical statement about some spinners. And it'll have, you know, what goes into the wild Lagrangian are wild spinners, but the Dirac spinner also is composed of two wild spinners. Okay? So just make sure that when we say wild, we are actually understanding it in the right context, okay? So when I mean here that that a generic Dirac spinner can be expressed in the chiral representation in this way. So this is a left-handed spinner, a wild spinner, and this is right-handed wild spinner. But note that in last lecture we showed that chi L and phi R star, they're both left-handed objects, right? That you can take a right-handed wild spinner and complex conjugate it, and then multiply it by sigma 2, and you get a right-handed spinner, right? So mathematically, you can have a well-defined an object which has this form then. There's nothing allowing you to say that the right-handed part of this Dirac spinner is actually has this form, right? So you're identifying physically the components here to the components here. You're identifying them. By doing so, you're reducing the number of physically independent degrees of freedom, because now in the previous case, you thought of this 2 degrees of freedom and these 2 degrees of freedom as independent. Now you're not. This is an example of a Majorana spinner. Although it has 2 physical degrees of freedom, this is not a wild spinner. It cannot be thought of as left-handed or right-handed. Because remember, a wild spinner in the wild representation would have either this zero or this zero, right? Here, neither of these components are zero. So to express what the definition of a Majorana spinner is in some representation independent way, we introduce the charge conjugation operator, which takes psi to its charge conjugate. It is not the Dirac, and it's defined by minus I gamma 2 acting on psi star. So once we have defined psi c, if we say that psi c is equal to psi, if we impose this condition is known as the Majorana condition. And in the wild basis, in the chiral basis, you know, the solution of this condition is this. There exists a representation of the Dirac spinners, of the Dirac matrices, in which a Majorana spinner is real. The Dirac matrices in that basis are purely imaginary, but the Majorana spinners are real. You saw in Dan's part of the course that for a particle to have charge, it has to be described by a field which is complex. So if the Majorana spinner is actually real in whatever basis, in some basis, that means that if you write down a Lagrangian, that will not have the global phase symmetry which allows us to describe charged particles. So Majorana spinners will not have conserved charges. Okay? So wild spinners will have conserved charges, electrical charges, but Majorana spinners will not. Sometimes in physics literature, the Majorana spinners are called real spinners because there is a basis in which they're real. Okay, in the last 15 minutes, I want to write down the classical solutions to the Dirac equation. And they're extremely useful and important for us. Sorry? Condition, yeah?
I'm not
an expert on the field, but you know, neutrino oscillations, you know, when you get, you actually have to use Marron spinners too. So I'm not exactly sure of the details of neutrino oscillations, but you know, but whenever, so yeah, Marron spinners are, so yeah, as the notation suggests, they are their own antiparticles. And whereas, you know, if neutrinos have masses, then, you know, the left-handed and the right-handed neutrinos are related. And I think they're described by the Majorana spinners. And I think the Stanmore course will talk about this. If not, you should ask your lecturer. So solutions, classical solutions to the Dirac equation. So let's take the ansatz of a plane wave. P here is for four momentum P, four momentum. Let's take this ansatz and plug it into the Dirac equation. But let's plug it into the Dirac equation in the chiral representation. So in the chiral representation, the Dirac equation will then become so U1 is now just the upper part, upper two components of U. So let's say U here is U1 and U2. The derivative operator in the Dirac equation brings down a factor of P mu, which is contracted with the sigmas, and there's a mass, and then we have U1 of P and U2 of P. Sorry? Okay. So this is, now let's take, so these are, we can think of these as two sets of equations. You know, the upper part and the lower part, and let's take a case where we have a particle at rest. So the four momentum P is just given by this. So if you plug it, if you look at this equation for this very particular choice of momentum, then you see that U1 evaluated P0 is equal to U2 evaluated P0. And let us define psi in this way, where psi is a constant two-component spinner, which satisfies this. So psi is constant. So in other words, U of P naught is given by this. So what we have constructed is a solution to the Dirac equation where the particle is at rest. And then we construct the solution to the Dirac equation at any arbitrary momentum, plane wave momentum, by making a Lorentz transformation where we just apply the Lorentz transformation to psi. So in this case, it'll act, so acting on this, you get the spinner at some arbitrary momentum P. And you can show, doing a bit of algebra, that this P dot sigma square root, and there is P sigma bar. Okay. And then the U bar of P is, of course, defined by U dagger of P of gamma 0. And then again, using some algebra, which involves using this identity and this, of course, the mass shell condition means p squared is m squared. The normalization of this thing is so now you see why choosing this in this way gave us a normalization condition for the spinner and its conjugate to be Lorentz invariant. Because M is just the mass, so it's a Lorentz invariant normalization. Okay? So this is a bit boring, but this is absolutely necessary. It's like brushing your teeth. Or I should say flossing your teeth. Oh, this doesn't work, right? Bang. Okay. This one is broken, I forgot. So now you can do the same thing for so these are called the positive frequency modes because of the minus sign pi here. We assume that p0 is positive, but famously, Dirac equation also has negative frequency modes. So you can also consider these things as solutions to the Dirac equation. V of p e to the power plus I p dot x. Again, p is positive. These are known as the negative frequency modes. Historically, Dirac interpreted this as having negative energy, because if you think of the Schrodinger equation and the energy operator of the Schrodinger equation, if you apply that, it'll have negative energy because of the sign here. Whereas those guys will have positive energy. And Dirac, you know, interpreted these as holes, which are now called positrons. We don't think of positrons as having negative energy anymore. So that's why we call it negative frequency modes. So always the wave, free wave part of the negative frequency mode always has positive sign. Well, it's all very confusing. So these are the negative frequency modes. And if you do the same thing, then you find that the solutions of the negative frequency modes are given by this. Now what I'm going to do is that because psi is two components, I'm going to say that, well, they're two linearly independent part. So I'm going to say we have psi s, and we're going to choose them in such a way that they're going to be orthogonal. Right? We can always do this. So similarly, we can introduce two etas, and then etas then will also have an orthogonality condition. So in the last 5 minutes, I'm just going to write down some identities for these spinners. And these are, you can prove them, and they're not very difficult. And I'm just not going to do them here. I've probably even forgotten how to do them. So V, so these are the identities. We have already seen this. Now, you can even compute what would be the inner product between U dagger and U. And it turns out it is not zero. It gives you the energy of the particle. And this actually is very useful in some computation. So you actually need to know this. But yeah?
I'm not sure I understand what this upper index stands for.
Oh yeah, sure. So U is written in terms of this two-component spinner psi, right? Now psi itself has two components. So it has two linearly independent components. So I write those as psi 1 and psi 2. And I can choose them in such a way that their inner product is orthogonal. So, you know, in some bases, you know, it could be psi 1 could be this, and psi 2 could be this. You know, in that basis, maybe, you know, this could be spin up, and this would be a spin down. Okay, so an eta is exactly the same thing, but for V. So this would be the spin up state for an electron. This would be spin down state for an electron, whereas this would be the spin up state for the positron and the spin down state for the positron. Okay. So note that, you know, this is not Lorentz invariant, and the way we have chosen our convention is such that this is also not Lorentz invariant. Because the energy is not the Lorentz invariant, it's just a zero component of a four vector. So similarly, V bar S of P and V of R of P will have minus 2m delta SR. And if you just did V dagger of S of P and V R of P, then you get plus 2EP delta S of R. OK? Yeah?
Always going to be a positive number before the delta?
This is a positive number, yes. So, yeah, very good. So, EP would be P squared plus M squared with a positive sign. Okay? Yeah. All right, so just a few more lines and we'll be free. Similarly, you can show that U dagger, U bar, and V is equal to V bar of U is equal to zero. If all the, and however, U dagger of V is not equals to zero, and we don't care what it is. And similarly, V dagger of U is not zero. However, so here we are assuming that their arguments are both the same at the same momentum. However, interestingly, if you take the U dagger but at minus the spatial, if you have minus p where it's the spatial momentum, and you have vs at plus p, that thing is actually zero. And in a lot of the computations you do in quantum field theory, in canonical quantization, you know, you use this identity to get rid of law of terms. So it's worth pointing out. Sorry, this is not very exciting, but as I said, it needs to be done. Okay? Sorry? Thank you for keeping me honest. Okay, and I have like one more page of algebraic stuff, and I think I'm just gonna come back to that next time. Okay. But just one comment before we leave is that if you look at the plane wave solution and you boost the solution in the ultra-relativistic limit, so you basically can ignore M, then you will be getting the Weyl solution to the Weyl equation that we talked about earlier today. Okay? Any questions? Yeah?
In this last equation, the P0 component is the same for both?
Yeah. Yeah, they're on Mass shell. So if they satisfy the Dirac equation, they have to be on Mass shell. All right, so tomorrow we will quantize spinners and get fermions.